All right, and so here in particular was an example that I gave. Here's an expression, not A or B. The compiler that I described actually produces this little program, which has four statements in it. But by looking at this, I can actually figure out a way of ordering things better and actually get it down to just two statements. So this introduces the notion of an optimized compiler, a compiler that takes what you write and tries to make it even better than it would have if it just took what you said literally. So there's turns out that there are people who spend their entire career creating such compilers, there are people who spend their time researching such compilers and coming up with other ways of thinking about how you might make programs faster. I mean, the nice thing about optimizing compilers, right, is that it doesn't put any additional burden on the person writing the program. It's basically, you can write the same program, but now it's going to run faster. The same hardware, same program, it runs faster. So that's a cool thing to be able to do. And I can't go over all the different kinds of optimizations, in part because I actually don't study this sort of thing, and I wouldn't be able to come up with a convincing list. But here's two small examples that I can tell you about in the context of what we've been talking about. One is this notion of shared sub-expressions, and another one is this notion of logical equivalence. So let me show you what these mean and how they could lead to more efficient code. So I think I won't get too deep into this example, but imagine that we're trying to come up with a program that computes the value, that computes the following expression. It takes A and B and C, or A and B and D, and computes that and stores the answer in E. So that's the program we want. And this is what the compiler that I described would produce for that. In order to get, this is really, if you draw it as a tree, at the top level there's an OR. So this is really this statement or that statement. So we actually, first thing we do is we compile the first statement, E equals such and such. To do that, it's actually an AND of two statements, so we do E equals the first statement, and this is just following the instructions that are earlier on in this lecture. To compile this code, we need to put A in the accumulator, then the accumulator into E, and then B into the accumulator, and then add them together, and so forth. We have a series of statements that come out of this process that if you execute them out, will actually do this. It's going to use one temporary variable N to get the job done, but apart from that, it's just very literally carrying out the sequence of expressions that are in this formula. All right, and so when all is said and done, it ends up using one temporary variable and a total of 13 instructions that have to be executed to make this happen. And so this is at least, you can do at least this well. Can you do better? So the first thing that I would say that's worth noticing is if you look at the expression that we're trying to compile here. It's got E equals A and B and C, or A and B and D. It's got this A and B in it twice. And what this program does here is it actually, you'll see in two different places, we've got computing the value of A and B here, and then we've got computing the value of A and B here. It does the same work twice. So you can imagine writing a program that takes a statement like this and goes looking through it to see if there's any common expressions, any expressions that appear more than once. And if there are, just figure out the value once, squirrel it away, and the next time you need it, just look it up. Sometimes that's called caching. It's basically, do the work that you have to do, and if you need that work again later, don't throw it away. Just leave it around so you have it when you need it. Right? That's a simple enough idea. Noticing when you can do this is a little bit trickier, but it's not that tricky. Right? You can imagine an automatic process that would just go looking for places where the same sequence of characters occurs. So we can actually get a little bit of savings in this case by computing the A and B, the A and B part of this, storing it in N, and then reusing it later in another part of the expression, instead of having to compute it all again. If you do this, we actually don't get any savings in this particular case. We still need 13 instructions, but now we've actually used two temporary variables to do the same thing. So if we had a much more complicated expression, this would pay off. And in this particular case, it doesn't. So one of the things that optimizing compilers do, actually, is they take the code, the program that you've written, and they try to translate it into machine language, sometimes a couple different ways, and just to see which one ends up giving you the shortest program, the fastest program. And if it finds one that it likes, that's what it actually produces to run. If it doesn't, well, it'll stick with whatever it's got. All right, so here's another one that we could do. So if you look at this expression, so A and B and C, or A and B and D, there's kind of an algebraic transformation that you can do. You can actually notice that A and B and C or D is logically the same. It's sort of like a distributive law of ands and ors that says that you can basically factor the A and B out of the expression. And if you do that, and then just translate this, I probably did it by hand, but you can translate this automatically, and you actually end up with a shorter program, faster program, that's like maybe 25% faster, just by noticing that, hey, wait a second, there's another expression that has the same value as yours, but ends up reducing to a smaller number of instructions. So that's kind of cute. So I'm not expecting anybody to know how to write an optimizing compiler or to be able to produce the output of an optimizing compiler. I just want you to have an appreciation for the idea that one can do this. One can optimize code. One can write programs that do this. And the better they do at it, the more you get speed for free, essentially. Now, of course, noticing when you can do these kinds of optimizations is costly, we say, at compile time, right? The compiler now runs more slowly, but it produces code that runs faster. If you only ever run a program once, is that worth it? Right? If you're going to run a program once, and you take an extra super-duper long time to compile it and make it run as fast as possible, and then you run it once, and blip, it's done, well, the time that it took to compile it was actually sort of expensive, and so probably it's not worth it. But if you're going to run the same program 1,000 times, a million times, you're selling it to lots of people, and they're all going to run it, it's all over the world, then all the extra time that you spend in compile time, creating code that's faster is going to pay off in a huge way. So that's sort of the trade-off. It's a natural sort of trade-off. I mean, you get this, you can spend a lot of time organizing your closets, but you don't want to spend a lot of time organizing a stranger's closet, right? You don't see, you don't really see a benefit of that. But if you're going to be using the closet day in and day out, that all the effort that you put into making it organized pays off for you. And that's sort of what an optimizing compiler is about. All right, so what I'd like to do now, these are now some slides that Barbara Ryder, who's a researcher in my department, a faculty member, a senior faculty member in my department, who does research on compilers. This is what she does. She has a group of graduate students. They write lots of papers about compilers and better ways of doing compilers and new compiler ideas. And I had her come and give a lecture last time. And so I think now we actually understand, we're now in a good position to understand her lecture slides. So what's a compiler? Compiler is a program that translates a computer program that people write into a machine language instructions that the computer can actually execute. So people write a program, it goes into what's called a parser, which in our case, builds that expression tree. Then from that, the output of the parser, we can use to generate code, generate the actual machine language instructions. Or you could imagine sending it to an optimizer that finds a better way of organizing the parse tree and then generate code that might be even faster. Parsers are really cool and worth spending a little time on, but I'm not going to do that. But what a parser does is it takes a high-level language in something like Java or C++ that people actually use in industry, and via a grammar, kind of like the grammar, grammars of English or other languages, grammars of computer languages are very formal, they tell you how you can put things together in the language. And so if you have a grammar description of what a legal program looks like in Java and C++, you can run that grammar to basically create something like the expression tree. They call them parse trees. And so that's the internal representation. That parse tree can then be used by the compiler to generate code. Code generator generates code. To sum up, that's what it does. The difference between interpreters and compilers: a compiler translates a program into machine language. An interpreter translates the statements by actually executing equivalent commands as it encounters them. There's no real translation step. It doesn't take the program and produce another program. It just takes a program and runs it. It does it. Interpretation requires programming language to have a defined meaning for its statements or semantics, sometimes defined mathematically, sometimes in English.
Somebody has to decide what the language means. All right, why do some people use interpreters? They do allow you to prototype new languages quickly. It's often easier to create an interpreter for a language than it is a full-blown optimizing compiler. One of the things that's neat about interpreted language is so Barbara's saying that portability, universality, so you can actually use the same language on lots of different computers, but the fact of the matter is you still have to port the interpreter. You have to make the interpreter run in all sorts of different. And that's true of compilers as well.
merely rewriting the VM.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's maybe not helpful to us in this class. All right, so one of the most popular languages in use these days is a language called Java. Some people may have heard of JavaScript. It shows up in, I was watching a Weird Al Yankovic video recently called White and Nerdy. It's kind of funny, you might enjoy it. It had echoes of many of my friends, not me, of course. I'm not White and Nerdy. But one of the things that he says that he's fluent in is JavaScript and Klingon. JavaScript, of course, being a version of Java that's actually designed to run on web servers, or actually web browsers. So a lot of you, when you visit web pages that do dynamic things on the fly, all of that interaction is written in a language called JavaScript that's actually running at your browser. So when you download the page, it's actually getting a program from the server that runs on your computer and makes it do all sorts of fancy things. So JavaScript is a language that's based on Java. Java is the kind of more serious version of it that people use. Let's see. So yeah, Java's popular. Klingon is a different thing altogether. We don't write programs in Klingon. All right, so Barbara was kind enough to generate for us a very brief history of programming languages. So the relationship between programming languages and, say, compilers and interpreters are anybody can invent a programming language of any kind, but no one will use it unless there's some way of actually running it on a real computer. And to do that, you need an interpreter or a compiler. And so these two things have gone hand in hand. If you come up with a new way to develop compilers, that may enable you to design a new kind of programming language. So in the 1950s, everyone had to write in languages like ML3, these very simple, very, very short statements that ran pretty much directly on the hardware of the computer. One of the early languages that people developed that was a little bit more people-friendly was called Fortran, stood for formula translation. And was very good at letting you write scientific computations, so number crunching, matrix multiplication, and all kinds of stuff like that. But then there was also a language called Lisp, which was good for symbolic, non-numerical computation, and a lot of people in artificial intelligence adopted this as a language for writing their programs. That was the 50s. In the 60s, it was the first time that anyone saw an optimizing compiler. IBM produced a Fortran compiler that could actually optimize itself, so optimize the code that it produced to make it even faster. So apparently that's the only thing that happened in the 60s, because I guess everyone was at Woodstock, I don't know. In the 70s, the first program analyses to enable complex optimizations were these programs are running and really just squeezing everything they can out of the code. In the 70s is when the C language was created, as well as the Unix operating system. Linux, which you may have heard of, is popular now, is a form of Unix that was actually developed, at least at first, by a guy named Linus. So this is Linus's Unix, or Linux. But one of the things that made it so powerful, Unix was developed primarily at Bell Labs, and then at Berkeley in California. And then AT&T, or Bell Labs, got all excited, like, hey, this is really popular, we need to own it. And so they closed it off from the rest of the world. And then it didn't kill it, but it did make it really difficult for things to advance. What Linux is a complete re-implementation of Unix from scratch. And developed by people who are willing to just give the code out for free. And so as a result, it's actually spread quite a bit more, and that's kind of the dominant form that you see these days. Optimized for time, space and time. So anyway, more kind of optimizations happening in the 70s. We get into the 80s, you start to see a very different kind of programming language appearing, object-oriented languages, things like Smalltalk and C++. The Hillis's book talks a little bit about object-oriented programming and what makes it different. Essentially, you write these things called objects. These objects almost act as if they were physical objects in the world. They respond to things as opposed to code that you execute. You call and tell it what to do. These are objects that are off doing whatever it is they do. It's a very different way of thinking about programming, but it's very appropriate for things like user interfaces, right? Where the user interface is made out of all these things that you can poke on and click on, and they all respond in various ways. The nice way to write programs for these kinds of interfaces is in this object-oriented style. People got very excited about parallel computers in the 80s, and I'm going to do a lecture on parallel computing later in the semester. In particular, things like the Connection Machine and the Cray supercomputer. Sometimes it's even crept into the languages, where the languages themselves allow you to take advantage of the fact that you've got multiple computers at your command at the same time. So that's kind of slick, and I'll talk more about that later. In 1990s, we started to see a shift in programming because of more and more people writing code that was meant to run on groups of computers that were talking to each other because of the internet. You see programming languages for explicitly distributed computation. So you're running a program that actually is taking advantage of the fact that pieces of it are running in different places. And then more on object-oriented languages, Java appeared in the 90s. In the 2000s, we were seeing people, and I think now Barbara's actually referring to sorts of things that she finds really interesting research-wise. I don't know how much impact these have had quite yet. But imagine writing compilers that are aware of the fact that they're going to have to run on a cell phone. Now, cell phones don't have a lot of power on them. And so not only do you want the code to run fast, but you don't want it to draw a lot of battery power. And you might actually be able to change the statements that you generate to make it generate or expend less battery energy. So it's a different thing to an optimizing compiler that is actually trying to make it not use up a lot of battery, which is kind of cute. Special purpose, domain-specific languages appear, scalability, distributed computation, ubiquity. They're everywhere. All right, and that's pretty much it for compilers. I'll pause if you have any questions or things that you want to ask about compilers. The main thing that I'd like you to get out of this lecture is not all the details of programming languages and so forth, but just this idea that what programming languages and compilers and interpreters let us do is make the leap from high-level languages that people find comfortable to write in to machine languages that computer designers find it easy to make their computers actually execute. Any questions about the compiler section that we've done? I have a question on homework 3 that lets you kind of practice some of these things. So at that point, you'll say, oh, I guess I didn't really get that. And you can ask me at that point. Anything else? Good? Ready to switch out? Yeah, go ahead.
About the what?
About the midterm,
sure.
Good, so I think my plan was to have it be on everything through homework 3. So basically that's all the lectures up until right this second. as soon as I flip into the next set of slides, that's not on the midterm.
Okay. So
we're now done the material for the midterm. Yeah.
Oh,
interesting.
Lecture 7.
So it's 1, 2, 2A. I mean,
yeah, okay.
9, 7, but not 8. Right? I moved compilers forward a little bit because it fits with the book better. Yeah?
Will the reading of the book be on the midterm?
So, as I said, I will only use questions on the midterm that I gave on the homework and tagged with the little yellow tag saying, I might use this on the midterm. So I'm not, the kind of clicker questions I've been doing to keep you up to date with the reading, I'm not going to have any explicit questions like that on the midterm. But, you know, you read the first 3 chapters and it gives you kind of a deeper sense of how these ideas relate to one another. You might find that useful. So I would definitely encourage you to read that stuff, but you don't have to study or memorize it. Yeah? Now you're giving me a bemused look. Is that all right?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Good.
Are you going to go over homework 2?
Homework 2, absolutely. Not today. But I will. And I may have to go over homework 3 before the deadline. Is that true? I want to go over homework 3 before the test that includes that material.
When are you posting homework 3?
Homework 3 was supposed to be available as soon as you get out of lecture today, but I think I have to click on a couple things to actually release it. It's done. Did you look at the new version with the fixed prep question 4? Okay, did you get to look at the fixed question? Okay, so I had one that I sent out to the TAs this morning and they said question 4 is insane, nobody's going to want to do that. So I rewrote question 4, but I haven't gotten feedback on that's less insane or that's insane in a completely different way. So I just need to double click sanity check that and then I'll release it. Any second. It's all done. Okay, good. All right, great. So in some sense, everything we've talked about up to this point is stuff that I didn't really know. and when I became a computer scientist, didn't really even care about all that much. All I cared about was, hey, I can write computer programs in a high-level language, and I can do various things with that. Of course, it's important to understand how it is that that high-level language is instantiated and actually run in the real world. And that's what I've been talking to up to this point. But the fact of the matter is, you can actually start here, and computer science is interesting even just starting from here.
Wait, is this going to be on the test?
So this is not, it will be on a test, but not the midterm. On the final. So now you can make a big heavy line and say, we're now done the first block of the course,
and we're moving into the next section. Now we have computers and programming languages, hallelujah, and now we can start doing things with them. Okay, good. So in particular, what I want to talk about is this notion of algorithms.
Which I assume is a word that people have heard, but maybe haven't really thought much about.
So what I'd like to do at this point is, in classic CS style, computer science style, this notion of reduction, I now will take everything we talked about as given, and the details no longer matter. All that matters is that I can program in a high-level language. And I'm going to take advantage of what I can do with that now. So what I'd like to do now is say a little bit more about the syntax of Python, so that I can show you Python programs and you have some idea of what they mean. Again, we don't have time in this class, nor do I know that everyone has the inclination to actually learn how to create complicated Python programs on your own. But I would like you to at least be able to step through and read them. And so to do that, it helps if I give a little bit of a Python tutorial. And I've kind of been doing this out in drips and drabs, but I would like to give a somewhat more complete description. Okay? So everyone okay with that? Now, one of the things that's neat about this is, presumably everyone's now downloaded Python, gotten it to run. There may be one or two people who gave up on that, but do try to get it actually running. If you go to your computer and you start Python up without any program at all, actually John might need to correct me about this. So how do you get the command line version of Python so you can type
on PC?
Yeah.
You go to start, then programs, and then there will be a Python directory, and you go into that, and there's a program called IDLE.
IDLE.
Which stands for, I forget what it stands for. Interactive something.
Yes, a dynamic language environment.
Sure. Anyway, that'll be the Python command line.
So if you go in and you run this program called IDLE, which you've probably installed, what it now does is it gives you a little prompt. In fact, I can show you what it looks like on my Mac anyway. I'm going to blow this up a little bit. It's probably too small. Doesn't look like he's blowing it up. It looks like he's making it smaller. That's only because I am. Hang on a second. Nope! That is not what I wanted. There's a way of making it bigger. Bigger. There it is. Okay. Does that help?
Can you read that?
All right. So you, at least on my computer, you get this > > > > which is just a prompt saying, you may type here.
That happens in IDLE.
Okay, so I have reason to believe it happens in IDLE as well. All right, so now I can start typing it. I can type things like print, hello. What does it do? It prints, hello. Computers are very literal, right? But you can actually tell it to do other things. You can say things like print 1 + 1, and it prints 2. Why? Because if I put quotes around it, I can do that too. If I put quotes around it, print 1 + 1, I mean literally print 1 + 1. But if I say print 1 + 1 without quotes, it says print the value of this expression. So figure out what this is equal to, and then print that value out. Now I can also store things in variables. I can say things like x equals, 17, or say 16 divided by 2. And notice it didn't have anything to say about that. Why? Because it did what I told it. It took the value of 16 divided by 2 and stored it in the variable x. Okay. Well, we can ask it what x is. Print x. Ah, 8. That's convenient. Now this you'll find a little weirder. Y equals x plus 1 over 2. So now, I'm going to ask you a question, and your answer is going to be the right answer, but it's not going to be the answer that Python gives. What's y? Okay, maybe you won't give any answer at all.
X plus 1 divided by 2.
X plus 1. Yeah, okay, but what is, I mean, we didn't put this in quotes, so we're not talking about literally that.
4.5 is what?
So 4.5?
But it's going to say...
Hold on a second. What did I hear?
It's
going
to say 9 over 2.
9 over 2, right? It could express it as a fraction. That would be correct. It's not going to, but that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And there are some languages that do that. Mathematica would do that. Anybody else have a guess?
I think it's going to say 0.5.
0.5.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is that?
Because
I don't have a good story for that. So x at the moment is 8. So 8 plus 1 is 9. 9 over 2 is what this is equal to. But it might want to write it, like a calculator wouldn't write 9/2. It would write 4.5.
Well, does it take the old value of x? Like, is this a continuous program?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, then I don't know what it's going to say.
Okay. Well, no, but you gave an answer that was good. Yeah.
Does it have order of operations program?
I put parens around it. So yeah, it does kind of normal order of operations where multiplication and division are done first left to right, and then addition and subtraction left to right. So it does sensible things with order of operations. But that's not the issue here. I actually explicitly put the parens to avoid that. I don't know, think crazier.
You haven't really given them enough information.
Yeah, and I realize that. But I want to point out that it's weird. What it actually does is weird. What is y? 4. 4? Why 4? Well, it turns out that Python has a notion of different kinds of things. It's got integers, right? Numbers that don't have any fractional part to them. It's got numbers that have a fractional part to them. It's got strings, you know, sequences of letters, like 1 plus 1 is a sequence of letters or symbols. This expression, because 1 is an integer and 2 is an integer, it thinks we want an integer. So it figures out that it's 4.5, and then it says, whoa, wait, that's not an integer. I'll give him back an integer. 4 is a good one. That's very close to 4.5. So it just chops off whatever's after the decimal. Now, if we want to convince it to do something else, and I'm just showing you this because it's peculiar, not because it really matters. We give it one of the numbers as a decimal, right? Something that has some part after the integer part. And now it says, oh, he wants the number that has a fractional part, so I'll give him the fractional part. I find this to be somewhat silly, but I'm sure that wiser minds than me had a good reason for doing it this way. We can also, here's another weird thing we can do. Let's say a equals tuna, print a plus fish. So now this is plus, it's a different kind of plus. What does it mean when you add together strings, sequences of letters? What would you want this to mean? Tuna fish? Anything else? It could be form of fish. We're adding tuna and tuna. No? Anything else? It could be that you interpret these letters as numbers and then add them and you get some weird string. But in fact, in this case, it means plus of strings means concatenation, means sticking the strings together. So you get tuna fish as a string. All right. I don't know. Does anybody else want to go into print anything? So at the moment, all we've seen so far are printing things and assigning variables. A couple mathematical operations like plus and divided by and concatenation. Yeah.
Can you define like programs?
Yes, we can do that. So let me make sure that I haven't skipped anything before I jump into that. So we can say things. This is what's in the notes, but this covers more or less the same things that we were just talking about. We can print a string, and it prints the string. We can assign a string to a variable. It equals hello. Now, if we print it, it'll print hello. If we print it in quotes, it'll print it. You can print it plus space plus it. Right? This is it in quotes, so it should be it, and then an empty space, and then whatever it is equal to, which is hello, and it'll get it hello. We can assign x tuna and y fish. We can print x, we get tuna. We can print x plus y, get tuna fish. We can print x plus space plus y, and we get tuna fish with a space in between. And we can print the string x plus y, and we get the string x plus y. All right, so this we've covered. What else can we do next? So the next set of examples are defining subroutines. All right, so you had a subroutine suggestion?
Define j parentheses x.
Okay.
And then, I don't know, x is greater than
say if x
one.
Is greater than 1.
Yeah.
Then
you can do it.
Thank you. If x is greater than 1, we can say print tuna plus x. No, that won't work. No, it won't, because we have to do like that. Back ticks? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, is that great? That's cool. I'm not going to do that. We'll print x, and otherwise we do nothing. Oh, okay, so what is this going to do? If we run j of 10,
I goofed a little bit, but it's, you know, it's a teaching moment. Well, what is this going to do? So what is it going to print if I do j of 10?
Let's
do it
to one at a time. So, did you have one? It'll print 10. What about like 9, 8, 7, 6, 5? No, you think not? Anybody else? I thought J printed 9, 8, 7. We did a J.
Yeah.
No, but I didn't put the recursive call in, right? So J of 10 is going to print 10. What about J of 0?
Nothing.
J of 0 is going to do absolutely nothing. All right, so let's try this again. Def J, we can just redefine it. If, see, you shouldn't let me do it myself, because as soon as you left me on my own, I messed up. Print X, and then we'll say, I don't know, let's call J of X over 2. All right, so now we can do something like J of 16, and we get 16842. Here's something that we didn't do on the board, because it gets a little messy. What is J of 30 going to do? All right, so J of 30, we look at the definition of J. 30 is greater than 1, so it's going to print 30, and then it's going to do J of 15. Okay, that's fine. J of 15 prints 15, and then it calls J of what?
7.
Oh, you guys are fast. Right, it's not 7.5, because it's going to divide 15 by 2 and want to give me an integer. So it'll do 7, and then what's next? 3, and then 1. Is it going to print 1?
No.
No, so it'll stop at 3. That's what we claim. Oh, we're so good. Look at us. 30, 15, 7, 3. Boom, it's out. All right? Good, excellent. We can also define subroutines that are not recursive. I may have biased you a little bit by starting with that. We'll define a subroutine called Q of name, and what, whoops, oh, I left out the colon. So here's the thing about computers, and this is, if you don't already hate this, you'll hate it if you start to play with programming languages. I left off the colon. It's obvious that I left off the colon. It knows that I left off the colon because it says, here's what you typed, and this is its own idiosyncratic, obnoxious way of saying it. Here's what you typed, and there's something that's gone wrong at the end of this line where I expected a colon, and you didn't put one, so everything has gone to hell, and I'm just going to stop. Like, it's not saying, hey, you forgot the colon, or I filled in the colon for you because you forgot the colon, sorry about that. No, it's just, blah. It's syntax error with no space between syntax and error. This is not intended for human consumption. And yet, nonetheless, syntax error, colon, invalid syntax, right? Like, it's a syntax error, and let me explain to you what kind of syntax error it is. It's a syntax error. Ugh, you gotta hate these things. All right, so here we go. Let me do it right this time. Got a colon. Boom. All right, so what is this gonna do? It's gonna print name plus, I don't know, don't you think? So, it's a nice day. It's a nice day, don't you think? No, all right, that's enough of that. There must be some better examples. Oh, so I didn't do anything much more advanced here. Here's an example in the notes. We defined our subroutine called D that takes as input X, it prints X, and then adds R delicious after that. So this is the adding R delicious. So you can say salmon, and it'll say salmon R delicious, which I don't think is even grammatically correct. Then you can say D of X. Now, X was defined on the previous slide to be tuna. Now, I'll say tuna are delicious. I probably should have made it is delicious, but there you are. All right. D of Y, fish. Fish are delicious. That kind of works, because fish can be plural or singular. X plus Y, it's going to first figure out what is X, what is Y, what are they stuck together. Then it takes that value and sends it into D, where it prints that value and then says are delicious. So it says tuna fish are delicious. If I put in X plus Y as the input, it's going to say X plus Y are delicious, which I bet you didn't know. But there you are. All right, so some simple subroutine stuff. One thing that I kind of did in passing, but I didn't really explain very well, is you can, in addition to defining subroutines that you call them and they do stuff, you can also define functions, which look a lot like subroutines, but they don't necessarily do anything. They figure out something and they give you back an answer. So here's an example. We can define a routine called S that takes as input Y and then gives back Y with fried stuff in front of it. And we all know that all you have to do to make something delicious is just stick fried in front of it. So what do we got? So we say, if we just said S of potatoes, it wouldn't actually do anything. You have to print what the value is. So print S of potatoes and it'll say fried potatoes. French fries. All right. Print S of X. Now X was tuna before, so we get fried tuna coming out. D of S of eggs. Okay, what is this going to do? It's going to take eggs, it's going to send it into S, which causes it to get fried stuck in front of it, That answer is then going to get sent through the D subroutine, which then prints whatever that is, are delicious. So this is going to say fried eggs are delicious. Okay, so we can compose functions. We can actually take the output of one and put it as input to the next one. Print S of X plus S of Y, we get fried tuna, fried fish. Because this X was tuna, S of X gives you fried tuna as a string, Y is fish, S of X gives you fried fish, and then we just glom them together with the plus sign. Fried tuna, fried fish. I don't know if that would be delicious or not, but it sounds kind of weird to me.
I don't know, what else could we do? We could also say, so S of X fries things, right? Return fried X. So print S of, Kit Kat. Fried Kit Kat. All right, so we can also say things like Z equals S of onions. So what just happened?
So it didn't do anything that you could see. But what did it do behind the scenes? It took the onions.
S is the subroutine of Z.
S is the subroutine that we define right here. It takes whatever comes in and puts fried in front of it. So it takes onions, it fries them, so we have fried onions, and whatever that answer is, it puts into Z. So Z now is a variable that holds fried onions. Now, usually you'd want them to be rings, but let's just say they're fried onions. So now we can print Z, and we get fried onions, okay? So it did that work, and it stored it away in a variable, just like we asked. Okay, good, then we'll just keep marching forward. All right, so I talked a little bit about if statements. These are some examples of if statements. So we can say something like num equals 17. So num is a variable. We're saying that take the number 17, store it in num. And now we're going to do a test. If num, which in this case is 17, is bigger than 10, then what are we going to do? It's indented here. So if this is true, it's only going to execute this print statement if this condition is true. And so it is true, so it's going to print multi-digit. It's bigger than 10. Should be bigger than or equal to 10. All right. Then, now it's done with that if statement, it moves on. The next statement has if num percent 2. Num percent 2 basically means what is the remainder if you divide num by 2? All right. If that remainder is 0, print even. Right. That's what an even number is. Right. It's a number that if you divide it by 2, you get no remainder. So this says if num percent 2 is 0, print even. Else, in other words, if this condition is not true, then print odd. So either this is going to execute or this is going to execute, but not both. It's going to figure out which one, depending on this condition, execute one of them, and then it's done with this whole if block. All right. And then finally, if num is less than 10, if this statement, in this case the statement holds, is false, so it's not going to do this, so it prints nothing. Right? It only does this if the condition is true. All right, any questions about that? What I didn't give here is an example where you actually have multiple statements underneath the if, and the way that you tell Python that is you have them all indented underneath it. So if I could have a whole sequence of print statements under here, but to tell Python that I'm done with that and I want to get back out, I stop the indent. Did you see an example of that? Or is that more or less clear? None of the above. Yeah. All right. So if statements, and I talked a little bit about if statements already today. All right. The next thing to talk about would be lists. So let me go over this. So this, it turns out to be useful not to just have individual numbers or strings or letters, but actually sometimes to be able to have whole lists of them. So for example, I can take the string Paul and George and Ringo and John, and then put brackets around them, and now it's a list of things instead of just one thing. And I can assign that to Z. So Z is now a whole list. If I print Z, it prints the list for me. But I can now also ask about individual elements of the list. So Z bracket 0 bracket refers to the first element of the list, the zeroth element of the list, which in this case is Paul. So if I settle to print that, it will print Paul. If I ask for Z of 3, let's see, this is the 0th one, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, it should give me John. Not that John. We can also, there's also this other little weird bit of syntax. If you say print z bracket 1 colon bracket, that means from 1 to the end of the list. So in this case, I get George, Ringo, John. Okay. We can also add lists together, which concatenates them to each other. So Stuart and Billy. I don't know, those might be the drummers that got dropped out of the Beatles. I think I did not pick these names completely at random. So we...
Peter.
So maybe I picked them completely at random. All right. So when you add two lists together, it just gloms the list together. So we had a 4-element list, then a 2-element list, and now we have a 6-element list. You can ask for the length of the list. Len of X is its length. Now notice by adding these two together, we didn't actually change Z. We just temporarily constructed a list, printed it, and then that got thrown away. You can also say print range of a number, and it prints all the numbers from 0 up to 1 minus the number you asked for. Another weird Python thing. Okay? Any questions about that? We'll see more examples of that, but just ask if it's not clear what it should be doing. I think that, would it be possible to just pull the door closed just so we can mute some of the... Yeah, mute some of the outside sound.
The original drummer of the Beatles was Pete Best.
Ah, all right. Thank you. That's right. Peter.
People make quick work of that. That is what I said.
Excellent.
It is? Yeah. I'm sorry.
He said Peter. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're right.
All right. So it turns out that you can think of a string like the name Michael or Tuna or whatever as being a list of individual characters. And Python lets you do that. So if you print X, you get Tuna. You can also say print the 0th element of X. In this case, the first letter of that. And it prints just T. You can say print everything from the first one on and you get Una. I don't think is a word. You can print, in this case, S of Y, 1 through 8. And what that means is, what was Y? Y was fish, and S of Y is fried fish. And so take fried fish and look at just the first character through the 8th character, the second character to the 8th character, and we get Rye 5, right? There was an F in front of it and an SH after, but we only printed a range of it. We can also define a recursive routine called reverse. Is that a question? Okay. Yeah, shoot.
For print X of 0, you got P.
Yeah.
Then print X of 1 and on, you got Una.
Uh-huh.
How come you don't have like a... Oh, okay.
Because it numbers from 0? Is that what you're wondering?
No, it's not... I was talking about the colon. I didn't do the colon.
Oh, yeah. If it would just, without the colon, it would have just printed
the U.
Yeah,
the U.
Yeah. So this means 1, etc. And I didn't say this before, but you can also put an ending point. You can also put just colon 8, which means everything from the beginning up to the 7th character. All right, so here's one way of reversing a string. If you have, I don't know, like a word like race car, and you're really curious what would happen if you reversed all the letters, then here's one way to do it. You can say if the string is empty, if it's a nil string, there's nothing in it, then reversing it is easy. It's just the same thing back. In fact, if it's one letter, the reverse is the same thing. But otherwise, reverse everything from the first character on, and then stick the first letter at the end of that. Alright? So this is a nice cute little use of recursion. If we're reversing a word like fish, we want to reverse fish. So here's what we're going to do. Somebody else, we're going to delegate this to someone else. Say, would you please reverse ish for me? So it's going to do whatever it does, and it's going to return back HSI. Now, we're responsible for reversing fish, so we're going to take whatever comes back from reversing ish, and we're going to stick an F at the end of it. We're going to take the first letter and put it at the end, which produces a reverse fish. It's sort of neat. All right, so in particular, if we type this in and then we say reverse swordfish, we get histrouse, right? It actually reverses it. If you reverse race car, you know, you can say that in the fastest. What do you get? Race car, yeah, it's a pounder. You can also do weird things like deleting individual elements of a list. Like we take Z and we say, just get rid of whatever was in the second position. Kill off, who did I kill? George, sorry. So George got deleted, so our new list Z consists of everybody in the old list minus whoever was in position 2. Okie doke. Numbers, we already started looking at those.
You can't add a number and a string. It will give you an error, and the error will be incomprehensible, but that's what it's saying. You can't add a number and a string. You can take a number and turn it into a string and connect them. You get things like one tuna. Very good. Loops, I think maybe I should talk about next time. Oh no, but it's the last thing. Loops takes a while to understand. And people were noticing that when I was, a lot of these recursive examples are actually loops. They're actually repeating the same operation over and over again with slightly different values. What's cute about, you don't have to just write loops in terms of recursion. There's things in Python that let you write them directly. So you can say, for B in Z, remember Z is a list of all the Beatles, print B plus was a Beatle. If you actually type that in, it'll go through and it'll say, Paul was a Beatle, George was a Beatle, Ringo was a Beatle, John was a Beatle. For each element of this list, it executes this statement. So, you know, it's like you own a whole garage full of cars. For each car in your garage, make sure that it's the inspection's up to date. So you have to check the first one, you check the second one, you check the third one, you check the fourth one. I just have the one car, but, you know, some people. All right, there's other sort of weird loops, like there's a while loop. What a while loop does is it repeats whatever you tell it to repeat as long as some condition holds true. So while x is greater than 1, in this case, add 1 to y, right? Take y, add 1 to it, and store the answer back in y, and have x. Take whatever x is, divide it by 2, and store it back in x, and keep doing that until x drops below 1, or equal to 1. Okay? Does anyone know what this would do? Say it again? Oh, no, it will. If we start off with a number like 1,000, it'll cut it in half and cut it in half and cut it in half.
If it gets to 1 and then it's going to add 1.5.
No, because remember these, since we're it integerizes it, right? So half of 1 in this case is 0. But this is, as long as it's greater than 1, it's going to do it. So once it hits 1, it'll stop. So it will, in fact, get down to 1. But if we start off x at 1,000 and y at 1, and each time we have x, we add 1 to y. So when all is said and done, x finally gets below 1, y has grown a bit. How much does y grow? What is y when this is all over and done with? Well, I give the answer 10, but what is this actually doing? Does anybody know? This is it's not a trick question, but it's an advanced question. Monica?
Power of 2?
No. Y is not, it's not x to the 2 to the 1,000.
It's a counter?
It is counting. Y is counting the number of times that we can divide x in half before we get down to 1. There's a name for that mathematical function. How many times can you divide a number in half before you get down to 1? You get log. Yeah, it's the log of x. The base 2 log in particular. All right, the last thing I want to do today, so now that we have kind of a notion of subroutines, or it's not subroutines, but the way that the high-level Python looks, I'm going to show you some concrete examples with Python in them to illustrate different ideas. But I want to just, for a couple moments, play for you an interview of a very famous computer scientist, a guy named Donald Knuth. He was interviewed on NPR, National Public Radio, and it was really interesting to me because the sorts of things he says are the sorts of things that I think, and probably most other computer scientists think, but I never heard anyone really say it out loud. And so this will give you kind of a window into the mind of a computer scientist. It doesn't look like it's working. It says it's playing. It doesn't look like it's playing.
It's buffering.
It's buffering.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. When Donald Knuth needs the power of a supercomputer, he has a resource that many others don't. Knuth can call up the folks at Google. They often let him tap into the same machines that search the entire internet. Knuth is legendary in the computer science world for writing a series of reference books called The Art of Computer Programming. They're part cookbook, part textbook, part encyclopedia, and it's hard to escape the feeling that they are also works of art. For this week's look at the connections between science and art, NPR's David Kestenbaum visited Knuth at his house. He's in Palo Alto, California, working on Volume 4.
The Art of Computer Programming books are all about the most efficient way for a computer to get something done. The general notion is captured in Knuth's kitchen, though. He and his wife designed it using a branch of mathematics called graph theory to plan what should go next to what, the toaster, the fridge, the stove.
The most important thing in the kitchen was the wastebasket. Everything wanted to be next to the wastebasket. So now our kitchen has a centrally located wastebasket, which you can easily toss things into from any direction.
Go up to the second floor, and on a shelf, you'll find multiple copies of the Art of Computer Programming books. One set translated into Russian, one in Japanese, Chinese, Hungarian, Spanish, German, Polish, and Romanian. Inside the books are ideas that transcend language, the essential grammar for constructing fast, elegant computer programs. What's the quickest way to sort a list of names? You'll find hundreds of pages on that in Volume 3. Best way to divide two numbers? That's Volume 2.
Page 235 to 240. And so here we have discussion of things that I learned in fourth grade, I think.
And is that the most efficient way to do it?
Nope. No, but this would be the best way to do long division until you have numbers that are maybe a million digits. And then you start to use much more clever ways where you change the problem.
Knuth's admirers describe him as a founding father of computer science. He pushed the idea that computer programs could be mathematically analyzed, refined, and made perfect, like poems, that there was a best way, an optimal algorithm for every task. Volume 1 of The Art of Computer Programming appeared back in 1968. Those were the days when computers were larger than cars. Knuth felt the embryonic field needed a central repository of knowledge, and he sketched out grand plans for 7 books. But now, over 3 decades later, Knuth is just completing Volume 4. He's 67 years old and works on the project constantly. The field of computer science is expanding almost faster than he can write and compile. Knuth is tall, thin, dressed in jeans and a black t-shirt. This morning's task is sorting things that will go into upcoming chapters. Knuth steers a book cart loaded with technical papers down the hall and into a kind of home library, which contains shelf after shelf of neatly organized folders. Knuth has managed to relate some unlikely topics to computer science. You can see that from the words scrawled on the folders.
Algebra, animation, Arabic language, asymptotics, axioms, barcoding. I've got about 15,000 items in these folders, and I'm going to have to boil this down into the final books.
I'm reminded of Samuel Johnson in the 1700s, compiling his Dictionary of the English Language. Knuth's books are personal, idiosyncratic, and beautifully laid out. You will rarely find a word hyphenated at the end of a line. That's because he spent 10 years developing what is inarguably the most sophisticated typesetting program. He once published a mathematical treatise on the shape of the letter S. Somewhere in a folder here is a short play written by a computer that appeared in Volume 2. Another folder contains papers on the golden ratio, which relates to how quickly certain search strategies work. It also happens to relate to this odd discovery, which will end up in the books.
Okay, Betsy Ross's five-pointed star. My wife found on the web this nice page that says how to cut a five-pointed star with one snip of the scissors. It starts out, says, take a thin piece of paper, 8.5 inches by 10 inches, and fold it in a certain way, and then cut with the scissors. And I worked out that actually, instead of 8.5 by 10, it should be 8.5 by 9.992349 inches, which is actually 17 times the sine of pi over 5. So Betsy Ross, was, if she really knew this, was amazingly close.
Even among very smart math and computer types, Knuth is considered a quick study. He occasionally gives lectures titled All Questions Answered, where he serves as a kind of gentle oracle. But Knuth prefers to think of himself as one of many bricklayers.
People think that computer science just is the work of a few geniuses. But the fact is absolutely the opposite, that there are just thousands and thousands of people doing things that build on each other, and it's like having a wall made of many stones.
The wall, however, needs constant tending. Knuth says that when he started writing the books, he knew there would be errors. His solution was to offer a small bounty for each mistake someone finds. Knuth's checkbook contains the names of famous mathematicians who caught real errors and master nitpickers who caught typos. Each spotted mistake earns a handwritten check for $2.56. That's a little joke. 256 written in the binary language of computers looks like 10 million, a 1 followed by 7 zeros.
Over the years, I've written checks for more than $20,000. This goes back more than 35 years. But people don't cache them as much as they used to.
Some people frame them and put them on the wall. With every correction, the book inches toward perfection. When the second printing of Volume 1 came out, 90% of the pages had changed.
And this gives us a kick to know that we're all contributing to the enterprise. We're competing against ignorance.
Knuth does stop to eat occasionally, or play the pipe organ in the living room, and presumably, he sleeps.
When I'm brushing my teeth, you know, I'm thinking, okay, there's 8 parts to my mouth. There's the upper teeth and the lower teeth. There's the inside and the outside. You know, there's the left side and the right side. But maybe it's best if I, you know, first do all the upper parts, you know, and, you know, I only switch from left to right. And there's ways to amuse yourself while you're doing things. And that's the way I look at efficiency. It's an amusing thing to think about, but not that I'm obsessed that it's got to be efficient, you know, or else I'm go crazy.
After lunch, Knuth bikes over to Stanford University. He helped found the computer science department there. He swims laps in the pool and looks up a paper in the math library. He wears his bike helmet indoors because, well, he was going to have to put it back on a little later anyway. Knuth long ago gave up email. It was too much of a distraction. He moves in general with a kind of steady urgency that seems to say, my time on Earth is limited and there is much to do, including 4 more volumes of essential knowledge to write.
Do you believe in God?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, I felt a call to write this book in some sense. It was something that I think would be bad if it could be proved, because then I wouldn't have to think about God anymore.
You mean if it could be proved that God existed?
Yeah. If there was a proof, you know, okay, I'd memorize the proof and then I'd go on and, you know, and forget about it. So the fact that there's a mystery there, it's challenging. It actually is, you know, it actually... it has deep meanings for me fairly often.
To some in the field, the art of computer programming is a kind of Bible. God does not appear in the index, but Knuth often kicks off new chapters with a philosophical quote, one from Shakespeare, one from a cookbook, and this from the 19th century writer Thomas Carlyle. Books are a triviality. Life alone is great. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
I think the ashes are perfect, right?
Okay.
And then we got the guys, I think.